Hello and welcome to the Dance Futures podcast, the podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. I'm your host, Dr. Ruth Pethybridge, self-confessed dance geek. This is the January edition and it is sneaking in just before the deadline. Probably like many funding applications that a lot of you are familiar with. I, for one, am not sorry to see the back of January, I have to say. I find it quite a tough month. So one step at a time, one dancing step at a time, I feel like we're getting closer to spring. And somehow it feels apt to be talking to the brilliant Kevin Turner on this month's interview. He runs Company Chameleon in Manchester. Do check out their website and the socials. And we talk, amongst other things, very openly about Kevin's own mental health struggles and how he's channeled that into the creative process. I then digest the interview with dancer in training, Luca Vaccari. And in that section, I bring my inner geek out and do a kind of record-breaking job, I think, of mispronouncing the second names of really established authors. So I can only apologise to them and to you. But if you are interested to follow any of those up, then please do check out the show notes where I will spell everything correctly and you can follow up anything that was of interest. If you're affected by any of the issues discussed in this month's episode, please do remember to reach out, whether that's to friends or to organisations, charities such as Mind. Many workplaces have support systems that you can access. Just asking for help is the first step. And I really hope that you enjoy this chat as much as I did, and see you next time. Okay, so Kevin, welcome to the Dance Futures podcast. Thanks so much for your time.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
So my first question to most people is just how you might talk about what you do to somebody who asks you, who's maybe not part of the dance kind of sector or world, who doesn't necessarily know. I know sometimes some people dread that question in a social context. So what do you do? I quite enjoy answering that because I feel like it's a gateway into talking about something that I really love.
Yeah.
And I realise that's a really privileged position to be working in a field that I love. But I wondered if you, how do you respond to that question when people ask it?
Well, it's a good question. Usually when people ask me what I do, if I'm not in a kind of arts and cultural kind of situation, or maybe it's a stranger and I just don't have the energy, I generally say I'm just a teacher.
Okay.
So I just say I'm a teacher. And most people don't really take it any further than that.
Really?
Yeah, honestly. But if people do push it a little bit, and I will say, well, actually, I am a teacher, that's part of my role, but technically my role is an artistic director. And when most people I say that to are not involved in the arts, I get a, what do you artistically direct? Do you know what I mean? I'm like, oh my goodness. So the way I break down my job is obviously, it says it on the tin. I'm an artistic director, so part of my job is being an artist. And part of my job is being a director. So I'm a co-founder and co-artistic director of Company Chameleon. And my role very much is split down the middle. Part of my role is obviously about making sure that the artistic program has quality and has ambition. I have to make sure that obviously that we are hitting our targets and making sure that we are making sure that we deliver upon those things that we say we're going to deliver upon.
Yeah.
Making sure that operations run properly, training, you name it. There's just so many different aspects to my job. So I'm kind of an artist and I'm also a director. I'm an artist and creative, and that's where my heart is. That's where I really feel that my heart belongs. But I do run a business, so I have to have a certain kind of business head on. And I really struggled with that at the beginning.
Yeah.
Going from the office to the studio, from the studio back to the office again. Because I just felt like it really occupied different parts of my brain.
Yeah.
But over the years, I think I've just, through practice, I guess, got used to being able to shift from those different headspaces. So that's what I generally say to people.
Yeah, I love it. It's so interesting, this thing of the kind of like the different levels, the different, like, who is this person? How much am I going to reveal? Like, because of the energy it takes, right, to potentially invite them into that world in a way that's kind of going to be meaningful to both of you to have that conversation.
Exactly.
I guess. Yeah.
And some people ask out of politeness.
Yes.
They're not asking because they actually really want to know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
So if someone comes with me and they genuinely, I get a sense from that, they want to know who I am and what I do, then of course I'll tell them what I'm doing. I'll give them a bit of a history and the rest of it.
Yeah.
But you know, come on,
I love it. You're an undercover artistic director.
Yeah,
we've all got to have our like kind of our cover roles. I love that. You said this thing about like dividing your time. I think it's like so going to be so recognizable to people who listen about kind of having to manage business sides of your kind of artistic work. And then, but you said that that's where my heart is in the artistic work. So and you mentioned the word practice. Mm-hmm. You were saying through practice, you've got better at managing that. But what is that heart then of your practice? Like, is that, how would you describe that? Maybe in language that I would
I think for me, ultimately what I'm inspired by is trying to create scenario situations in which people are inspired and moved. Fundamentally, that's what I always try to do, whether that's in my teaching practice, my choreographic practice, my performance practice. I'm always trying to get to a place where it's meaningful and there's something meaningful being communicated, and that's really, really important for me. I do have a real interest in masculinity and the issues that surround that. And that forms part of my practice. But I also, over the last few years, since 2016, I've been making a lot of work around mental health and well-being, and also not only just making performative work about that, but also creating community engagement projects where I kind of engage with those who do have existing mental health challenges, and also those who are at the risk of having mental health challenges. And that's something that's definitely become a bigger part of my practice since 2016. Mm-hmm. So that
idea of like inspiration, have you ever failed? Do you ever feel like, that thing of inspiration, I find that really interesting, that thing of I think you have a really inspiring presence.
Yeah.
And I can feel that energy, you know, that you can bring into a room, which is really beautiful. But
well,
I wonder,
you.
Do you ever have that thing where you're like, oh, you're bringing that energy and it's not being kind of met, or like that, I don't know, I suppose I'm thinking about situations where inspiration feels like quite a long way away for people.
Yeah. The easiest and most direct answer is yes, I have.
Yeah.
But then I don't necessarily see it as, I see it as a challenge that needs to be overcome. And what can I do as a facilitator to create the environment and the space where people feel comfortable to step into a creative space?
Yeah.
So for example, you know, some of the work that I do, I work with all types of people, from young people to professionals. And part of some of my work that I've been doing in the last few years is going into secure mental health units and prisons. So in a prison, for example, well, first of all, it's a prison.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so there's the whole things that, all the ideas and behaviours and energy and kind of routine and structure that comes with that. You know, but rather than going, oh, this has fallen flat, it's my role and my job as a facilitator and artist to find those tools, or to find the common ground that we can meet so that we can then together make something together. So it's not about me going in and creating some kind of imposition upon them. And there has been times when I've gone in there and, you know, things have happened in the night before or in that morning or whatever, and the participants, I'm talking very specifically about prisons right now. So they might be coming into space with all kinds of other stuff that's gone on.
Yeah.
So who am I to go in there and go, well, I'm going to inspire you today?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a bit patronizing.
Yeah.
So, sometimes the things that I offer fall flat. But then rather than seeing that as a negative thing, which I may have done in my earlier career, I see it as an opportunity to learn. Basically. So obviously these strategies and these methods are not working. So what will? And then it's my responsibility then.
Yeah.
as a facilitator to pull those things out of people, to get them engaged, to get them enjoying the space,
yeah,
to get them to have ownership of over what they do.
Yeah.
So I'm one of those like people that try to not see failure as failure. I try to see it as an opportunity to learn, if that makes sense, and grow from.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And I think it's, again, something that you have to practice, right, in life and in work.
Absolutely.
But I think, yeah, I just really, and I think it's quite important to sometimes unpick these ideas around inspiration and aspiration and things, because we can say that and know what we mean in those specific contexts, but it can sound like you did a little example, didn't you, of that thing of going in and being like, hey guys, I'm the dancer, I'm gonna kind of come in and change your lives, and it's never that
I wouldn't go simple. Into a prison like that anyway though,
to be fair.
Ruth.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, I'll give you a perfect example of inspiration. We're talking about inspiration. We were doing this project in a prison with, and I never ask about what the participants' crime is, because to be honest, it's irrelevant.
Totally.
To be honest.
Yeah.
So, especially with this restorative kind of approach that I'm using.
Yeah.
So, for example, we went into this one prison and we were doing this project, and we had lunch, and the guys went back on the wing, and they came back, and one of the participants had a guitar, and he was like, "I'd really like to play." And I was like, "That's amazing." I didn't think of anything of it. I was like, "He just obviously just wants to play." And he sits down in front of everyone. He starts playing, I think it was an Oasis song, actually. He starts singing it. And the guy had a really, really good voice, actually. And he could really play really, really well.
Yeah.
And everyone was, like, vibing off it and stuff. And then he finished, and he was like, "That's the first time I've been here for 10 years, and I've never played in front of anyone before. I've only ever played inside my cell." And I was like, wow, that's interesting. So, obviously, he felt that this space was safe enough for him to be able to share that. That inspired me.
Yeah.
I think it inspired other people in the space. And then when we left, he was stood on the wing, in the middle of the wing, playing guitar for everybody.
Amazing.
In the wing. So, you know, I know inspiration can be a word that seems a bit ethereal or kind of, I don't know, intangible or something like that. That for me is inspiration.
A really clear example, yeah. And also, but also I think recognizing that it's two way, and that how much they also inspire you, right?
Absolutely.
And like kind of show you different facets of what it means to be courageous in certain situations, and things like this. So I think, yeah, it's just important to recognize those two way streets.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's a really beautiful example. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
You mentioned about since 2017, is it called Witness This? The piece that you made that was dealing very openly with mental health struggles, and you've been very open about your own.
Yeah.
Is that how, I guess it's sort of, I'm curious about that process of taking something so personal and putting it in the public realm.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm just thinking this is a really big question, but like how that was in terms of a creative process, I guess. How do you do something like that when it's so personal and put it into the public realm?
Yeah, I hear you. I felt like I didn't have any other choice but to do it. When I left hospital, there was three things that I wanted to do after I'd spent some time in a mental health institution. I wanted to go back and teach a workshop within a secure unit, because that was the only respite I had when I was in hospital. And I managed, at the time, I didn't know how I was going to do that or whether I even could do that. But it was an aspiration that I had, which I eventually did. And then the second thing I wanted to do is I wanted to make a piece about my experiences with my mental health. But it wasn't a piece that was like, oh, woe is me. It was about, this is an event and a crisis that's happened, but actually I wanted it to focus upon those that surround the person who's suffering, because their story is often the story that's not really spoken about.
Yeah.
And it's never just one person. Obviously in certain cases, people who are maybe orphaned or in care and they don't have a family, then maybe obviously they are totally isolated. But luckily in my case, I've got a very loving family and great friends, so I had that kind of support network around me, and I really wanted to make sure that I told their story, because if anything, I think their story is more important than mine. And, you know, for the artistic process, I suppose what made it slightly easier was I had, because I was so poorly and was so unwell when I got sectioned and sent to hospital before and during and after, it was very difficult for me to understand what had happened because my timeline was completely fractured. Mm. Because I was so unwell and I was psychotic, some things I couldn't remember, I just could not straight out remember. Other things were like half cloudy, fuzzy memories, but I couldn't really make sense of it and I didn't know where it was in the timeline. And some things I could remember really specifically. Mm-hmm. But my memory was quite bad. So I had to go for a process of actually interviewing those people who I loved and my loved ones who were around me to basically get a sense of what happened, really, to them, wow. to me, to everyone. Yeah. It gave me an opportunity to apologize and take responsibility for some of my outrageous behavior. Although my family were like, you don't have to apologize, you were unwell. And I was like, thank you, but I still want to take responsibility. It was really important Amazing. For me to do that. And and I just interviewed them as part of the research process and just kind of got stories, anecdotes. How did they feel? How did they respond? What were they thinking about? What did they do? How was I? How did I act? And I was able to kind of use all these kind of anecdotes and stories and images and energies and connections and events that had happened as the basis of the ingredients for the work, really.
Amazing, yeah.
And then we just went into the studio, and luckily I've got a great team of artists that I really trust.
Yeah.
And we were able to kind of create a really safe,
where you're able to take risks and some kind, I guess, absolutely.
But I mean, safe, but really.
It's a word on the tip of your tongue.
It is, and I can't get it out. Everybody was prepared to go there.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of a better way to phrase it. So because we had that trust in the space, and we all respected one another, and we were all going for a process together. In any of the scenes that I improvised or created or set up or any kind of devising kind of approaches, we were able to go there.
Yeah.
And that really allowed us to kind of not shy away from difficult choices or difficult experiences that we experienced along the process. And I think that there was a lot of conversations that was had. There was a lot of understanding that was... That the artists that were involved in the piece, because all of them had no experience with anybody or themselves with a serious mental health condition. So I think we all learn a lot about one another and about taking care of one another as well in the process.
Yeah.
Although I will say that when we went to perform the work, I didn't take care of myself because... sometimes after the performances, it was really difficult for me because I tend to try to be as invested in what I do as much as possible. And I'm trying to create some sense of authenticity. You hear about people who do kind of like... method acting and stuff like that, and
I was just thinking about that,
and how Daniel Day-Lewis after he creates a film, it can take him up to 18 months to get out of that character. That's how deep he goes into it. I'm not saying I go that deep because I don't have the time, the money or the resources, but I certainly go very deep into something. And I don't, looking back, I did not put things in place to support me in that way. Although I was really conscious of making sure that all my artists had that in place.
And there, that's the issue, right, with being the kind of artistic director, like parenthood, isn't it? You look at, make sure everyone else is okay, and then, oh, me.
Yeah, you somewhere get lost in the middle of it somewhere, don't you?
Yeah. I think Now, I wanted to say two things, one of which is in terms of inspiration, that thank you for talking so openly. And I know you're probably sort of quite used to it by now, but it is really refreshing. And I think it is a day and age where mental health is talked about more openly, but it's really, really important to hear people who have also been through these kind of crises moments and come out and manage to kind of make sense of them in different ways and using creative resources to do that. So it's really, that is definitely inspirational for everybody to hear. So
I think for me, it's if in any way by me sharing my experiences raises awareness or is an example to people who are in a really difficult position, that it is possible. Things do change.
Yeah.
Things can change. And although I am fully aware of how in the moment it may seem like it cannot, and I know that feeling intimately, if there's anything that I can share with any of your listeners, is that it does change. Change is the only thing that is kind of set in the whole universe.
Yeah.
And it's just about giving yourself the time and hopefully having the people around you who can help and support you get back to being well again. And ultimately it's about love, and ultimately it's about creating the space to really talk about how you think and feel.
Mm.
Really talk about how you think and feel.
Mm.
You know, and I always pull my friends up because, you know, I'm Northern, I'm from Manchester, I'm a bloke. I just am. That's just me. And, you know, a lot of my friends are not artists in Manchester, you know, school friends or whatever. And, you know, the conversation goes like this. You're right, lad. How's it going? Yeah, yeah, good. How's it going? Yeah, yeah. That's it. That's it. That's how it was.
Yeah.
That's how it was. Yeah. Now we actually have conversations about how we feel.
Mm.
Don't get me wrong, they're not that sophisticated. But at least they tell me how they feel. Do you know what I mean? And we always do this thing of checking in.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've brought that to my friendship group now, where when we meet up, we do check in with one another.
Yeah.
And
that relates, right? You were saying that masculinity is something you're quite interested in your practice, and how that's informing relationships and presumably your practice as well.
Yeah, so, and some of the works I've made as well.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. I think that I remember speaking to a Professor Gabriel up at Manchester University, who is an expert in kind of like women's studies, women's studies, I think it's called.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, that's it.
And she said something really interesting to me, actually. She said, there's been, since obviously New Wave Feminism, New Wave Feminism since the 60s or whatever, there's been a lot of research and time and thought gone into understanding and defining womanhood.
Yeah.
And this is not my words, this is her words. She believes that masculinity needs exactly the same.
Yeah.
Because I personally feel that men are in a bit of a crisis. And some men I know are reaching for archaic models because they just don't know how else to navigate life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
But those archaic models don't work anymore.
Yeah.
So, but there doesn't seem to be a model that's come in to replace it. So then you're in this situation. I'm not saying this for myself. I'm just saying that a lot of people that I know, and to me to a certain extent, it happens this way as well.
Yeah.
It's just what can we do to redefine what masculinity is? And I think that's a question that still hasn't been answered yet.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's an ongoing question. I think queer culture has a lot to offer us in terms of kind of understanding different ways of embodying what being a man is, that doesn't necessarily have to do with your sexual orientation at all, but is actually just to do with ways of being and ways of relating. So I think, but that's still, you know, that's still marginalized. And again, then you have the, and it's very mirrored in dance, actually, isn't it? The way that the men can be, it can be conflated with the idea of your sexuality if you're a dancer, which I am sure you've come across. And big eye roll from everybody. And then so those conflations between like how your practice is then perceived, because or how you're perceived because you're doing certain things, when actually those might be the very things that are going to help to kind of disturb and dilute the kind of toxic masculinity archetypes that, like you say, people are still reaching for. That's
I just don't think there's been, I mean, for myself, I'm really lucky. I'm an artist, so, you know, I'm first and foremost before everything, so I'm really lucky. I'm really fortunate in the sense that I've met so many different people, but so many different backgrounds, from different cultures, different countries. I've traveled loads. I've been here, I've been there, I've been everywhere. So I obviously have a very privileged perspective on things, and I've been around so many different types of people that for me I have less trouble with it. But I do see non-artistic or cultural sectors workers, I just see them struggle with it in a massive way, and it's just a question that I have about what can I do as an artist to.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. Do you
promote that conversation create a work about it create some kind of project or initiative? Because that's always think, you know, I'm not a mathematician, I'm not a policymaker, although I do feed into policy to a certain extent. I mean, so that's straight away where my thoughts go to. So what can I do?
Yeah, and I think that's so important with any kind of social justice cause as well. It's like, you know, I sometimes joke about this meme that was doing the rounds during the pandemic, you know, like where the world is like burning behind him and someone's going, does anyone need any choreographers or dancers? You know, and it's kind of where you can get into this thing where there's this feeling of like, oh my God, you know, the world's in such a mess and I'm moving about, you know, and I don't subscribe to that at all. I subscribe to the fact that dance is a really, really valuable and important thing that cultivates, again, these different ways of being in the world, you know. But I think sometimes with activism, you feel like it's too overwhelming because you're looking at all these problems in the world and you're like, you can't solve them. And it's about looking at where your skills are and where you what your energy is, what you're good at, basically, and bringing that to the world and seeing how that can intersect with whatever it is that you care about that's going to make a positive change in the world, and kind of bringing that to the table. And I think that is how we avoid burnout when you're trying to like solve everything and do everything.
You can't do everything.
You can't.
It's impossible. And I absolutely agree. Like, you know, I make work. Yeah. I create projects that involve people.
Yeah.
Who may be dancers or may not be dancers, and everyone in between. So, yeah, I totally agree with what you said then. That's what I feel I can do, what I can contribute as a dancer. That's why I'm making up all these different programs and schemes around movement and well-being.
Yeah.
Because that's how I feel I can make a positive impact. Because I know that just the very nature of moving your body will make you feel better. Now, if you move your body with purpose and it's used as a gateway to communicate something that's going on with you or share your internal world, even better. Yeah. So I totally agree with it. You know, it's choose your war and choose your battles, because you can't do all of them, can you? You know, and for me, it's also about, well, what am I doing on a daily basis?
Yeah.
You know, how do I treat people?
Yeah.
How am I respectful? How can I embody the values that I find important?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people sometimes underestimate how powerful a smile can be. I mean, Spike Lee talked about that. You smile and this goes halfway around the world, doesn't it? And even within my own practice of when I'm working and connecting with people, how can I be, how can I support them? How can I enrich them? How can I give them tools? How can I help them explore and be as involved as they can be in whatever it is they choose to do?
I read something the other day, and it's probably one of these like slightly half-baked things. I said a recent study said whatever, and who knows how rigorous this was, but it was talking about how these little interactions that we have with strangers through the day, and how much that can improve your sense of well-being, basically. And I was having a really shit day, as you do, the other day. And then I just had one of these interactions with, you know, somebody who was serving behind the shop, you know, a little bit of banter, a little smile, somebody who normally our paths probably would never cross. And I did come out of that interaction and I was like, yes, this is why kind of also why COVID's been so difficult.
Yeah.
And why kind of being shut away and not able to have those kinds of spontaneous interactions and little moments of kindness that make you feel like humans might just make it.
Oh, absolutely, they will make it. I'm a great believer that there's more nice people than terrible people. There's definitely more good people than bad people. And I also believe that anybody that's bad is just misguided in their actions to ask for love.
Yeah.
So I perceive it.
Yeah.
So they are lacking something. Their yeah. needs are not being met
totally.
In some way.
Yeah.
Now, it's not my responsibility necessarily to match those needs.
Yeah, that's a lesson right there. Yeah.
Because particularly if it's an adult, and maybe if I don't know them, then, you know, it's not really my responsibility to educate them, I guess. And sometimes people don't appreciate being educated anyway, do they? But at least I try to just think of it in that way. Their needs are not being met in some way. Somehow, because everybody wants to get on.
Yeah, totally.
But it just everyone's just got a different idea of what that means.
Yeah. So just rewinding slightly, the brilliant, simple kind of takeaway, which was if you move, you will feel better. If you move your body, you will feel better. So I love that. We should all get a T-shirt with that on.
Yeah. It's just true.
It's just true. I totally agree. And sometimes it's like seems overly simplistic when there's so many complex issues that people are facing. But it's also movement can simply be that step to going downstairs to the kitchen to make yourself a cup of tea.
Absolutely.
When you're in overwhelm or freeze. It doesn't mean, okay, everybody, let's get up and dance again. For some people, it might be. For me, it's often Whitney Houston.
Oh, I love it, Whitney. It's got to be Whitney.
But on that note, then, just to kind of finish up, I guess, you're talking about how change is really the only constant that we have. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in terms of like dance futures, the future of kind of dance or your practice that you might like to see change? Or what would you like a dancing future to kind of look like? So I have this vision, for example, that we can have, maybe we can have Whitney pumped out the bus stops. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd love a bit of Whitney pushed out the bus stop. That'd be absolutely amazing. I think everybody's journey would be happier. Okay, I'll be, I teach a lot in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
And this is slightly controversial, what I'm going to say.
Love a bit of controversy on the Dance Futures podcast.
You know, I go to a lot of different universities and a lot of different conservatoires here and abroad, but I'll just talk about the UK. There's an issue in contemporary dance around diversity.
Yeah.
Mad issues, man. This is not a slur. It's just an observation. It's white, it's middle class, and it's female.
Yeah.
And I don't see lots of people of colour, and I don't see lots of people from the lower socioeconomic kind of elements of our society, and that concerns me.
Yeah.
I come from a very humble beginnings, like really humble, not from an arts family at all. And I think that there are those routes for people to engage in the arts, particularly young people from diverse backgrounds, but something's not working.
Mm.
Something's not working.
Mm.
Now, my responsibility as an artistic director is, well, what can I do to change that? As always, it's the question, what can I do?
Yeah.
As a quote-unquote leader. So we're doing lots of work about kind of developing a really diverse dance project where we're going into specific schools in Greater Manchester to really try to start at this end of the pipeline, trying then feed them into our Talented and Gifted program, which is our Chameleon Youth, to then hopefully then pipeline them towards professional studies. But people are not doing enough on the the grassroots end,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah.
So that's why we're shaping and thinking about our projects and initiatives moving forward to address this problem, because it is a problem.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a problem in the sense because the plurality of experience and diversity of thought makes it better for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Full stop.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of controversy.
I don't think it's controversial. Well, I think it's like absolutely bang on, and like I hope being recognised more. I think it relates a bit to the first question about inspiration that you said in the relation to sort of like how do we create those spaces where that's welcomed, that feels like that you belong there. That's the question that I have. This is where I get like the structures are not supporting it. So then I get overwhelmed and I'm like, okay, what can I do? And then you're like, okay, so how can you create the spaces that are inviting, if you like? Do you know what I mean? But also the practices that are inviting. Yeah. So it's not things that are like really alien to people, that are only the things that are valued to be studied. So this is a huge thing for me. It's like blow open the hierarchies of what's deemed as acceptable and deemed as worthy of study, right? Yeah. So this is... I teach a lot of theory, so that's what I try and do in that. It's like whatever you're into or whatever style it is you're bringing, let's look at that. We can study that. It doesn't have to be romantic ballet from the 1800s or whatever. So these like tiny adjustments in terms of our hierarchies of knowledge, I think, can help. But you're still, like you say, the bottom up, the grassroots.
Yeah, that's where it starts. The pipeline is the start line.
How we get down to that pipeline.
I think part of it is making sure that the people and the practitioners, it's a bit chicken and egg.
Yeah.
Because you need to have practitioners that represent the communities that you want to serve.
Exactly.
But if there's no practitioners that represent the communities that you want to serve, then it's a bit chicken and egg, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So
we need
to... I haven't squared that circle yet.
No, I know. I was trying to think of a good metaphor for like what would be the alternative, you know?
But I do think that's part of it.
Yeah, I do.
I think
there's
a big part of it.
Yeah. No, because
if you don't see someone who's like you,
absolutely,
you don't think it's for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I grew up, I didn't know it was possible to be a professional dancer.
Yeah.
That's what white people did in London.
Yeah.
Went to the Royal Ballet, and that's what you did, isn't it? That's what I thought. I had no idea. How am I going to know?
This is pre-internet days.
Do you know what I mean? People forget.
I know, right?
Like pre-internet,
you see all these images. Yeah.
You can't
Google it.
There's no Google. You have to go to the library. You have to go to the library to get books on things to try and figure out what's going on and understand stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But even then, it's like, you know, you might not find the book or the resource that you're looking for.
You're making me feel old, Kevin.
I'm the same age as you, so when you say this, what I'm saying. Nowadays, people don't understand the resources that they have online. Like they go on the phone, they go on the laptop, they can watch this piece, they can watch that style, this influenced by that. I remember my friend gave me, when I was about 13 years old, he gave me a breaking VHS tape.
Yeah.
It had been watched that many times. It was like, you know, the snow on the side.
Yeah.
And he gave it to me as if it was like a golden bar.
Oh my God, amazing.
I had to like literally guard it with my life. And then when I'd learned everything I needed to learn from it, I passed it back to him and he passed it on to someone else.
Yeah.
This is what I'm saying.
Yes, yeah.
Young people don't even understand. And do you know how many times you had to rewind that VHS tape back? How many times I rewound that tape back? Play, rewind. And it's all grainy. What's he doing? What is that going on? That is
proper discipline there and dedication. Do you know what I mean? That is, you were like already forming your discipline.
It's the only way to do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, but I think what's happened now, we're in a situation where there's so many resources at hand.
Yeah.
And people sometimes can get a bit overwhelmed, so it can go both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a student here. We have the first time in recent years we had a student who arrived in the university context having only ever learnt stuff off YouTube.
Oh, wow.
And he completed a degree. And
good on him.
Yeah.
Or her. Or them.
Him. It was him and I really enjoyed working with him and the kind of the approach that he brought, you know, and I kind of hope that those kinds of things will also kind of blow open the gatekeeping of the academy, which dance already does to a certain extent, because we're already not really meant to be here, let's face it. Well, that's what some people think. I mean, I think we should be, but
yeah, me too.
So yeah, thank you. That's like loads of food for thought and lots of inspiration to use that word again. See you for some Whitney Houston at a bus stop sometime, maybe?
I absolutely love that. What's your favourite Whitney Houston song?
Well,
it's a bit difficult to choose on it.
It's hard, isn't it? Because obviously you go to dance with somebody, mm-hmm. but then you forget that there's like Love is a Contact Sport or How Will I Know?
There's just so many, isn't there? Have you seen The Bodyguard, the movie, innit?
Yeah.
Do you remember when it first came out?
And the synths.
Yeah. The synths. It's all about the synths, man. We come from the synth generation.
We do come from the synth generation.
These kids are trying to copy it, but they don't know. Original. Well, thank you, Ruth.
Awesome, Kevin.
No problem.
All right. Hey, Luca.
Hello.
We are recording our little digestive this week. Mmm, yummy. We like to do, we love digesting these interviews. In a vintage shop called Out of the Closet, which somehow seems appropriate.
Yeah.
We're a woman down because Robin is not feeling so great today, which I think is in itself kind of maybe relevant, isn't it? This thing of sort of allowing ourselves to not do stuff when we're not feeling great.
Yeah.
Which kind of resonates with some of the themes that we were talking about in Kevin's interview. What were your takeaways from that, Luca? What was your impression of it?
Well, I suppose what's maybe a bit unusual about this interview is Kevin is one of the first guests I've had the pleasure of actually meeting and working with. So I feel like I have a slightly different connection to the interview this time around because I have personal experience working with Kevin in a dance context. So as he was talking, I was like, yeah, I can really see how he instigated these practices in the way that he taught us in the studio, which was really cool. And I think everyone who was in the studio really took quite a lot away from the experience.
Nice. Yeah. And I felt like there was something, like I said it in the interview, but this thing of sort of really being honest about his kind of own mental health condition and struggles in a way that I feel like sometimes in the professional realm, again, we sort of try to have these fronts or these kind of roles that we play. And sometimes that's useful, right, as well, because we sort of have to leave our stuff behind and step into something. And I sometimes find that helpful to kind of leave some of that baggage, as it were, at the door. But I really also feel like, yeah, it's so important to be able to kind of own what's going on for you in a way that gives permission for other people.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of the world of contemporary dance does follow trends like any other artistic industry, any other industry, full stop. And sort of the past 2-3 years, the real buzzword was mental health. But what's so great about hearing Kevin talking about his work is that you know that it comes from a place of real authenticity, and it's not sort of a tick box exercise to get funding or to like get work on stage. You know that it's actually coming from a real place of, hey, I've got something to say on this matter, and I think other people can benefit from seeing dance about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also just the thing of sort of taking care of yourself in whatever creative process you're sort of involved in, really. I thought there was something really key in that, in the sense that although... Oh!
Wow.
Passing motorbike, boy racer. Shit, gender stereotypes, it might have been a woman. Just saying. Taking care of yourself through that process, that even in that situation, you know, you get kind of excited and intense about what you're doing, and then that can lead to burnout again. And I think creatives are sometimes more prone to that because we can throw ourselves into things and just get fully immersed.
Yeah,
want it to be perfect and everything. And yeah.
Yeah, I just think the way that Kevin was able to talk about mental health, it's still a really big taboo, really. And I think as soon as people know that a piece of dance or an interview or a book is going to be about mental health, people can really sort of get a little bit scared about it and, and a bit hesitant to sort of interact with it. But I think just being really kind of upfront about things, but also being able to say it in such a calm, measured way really
helps.
Yeah,
matter of fact as well. It's kind of like, this is, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I feel like this is rehashing things that have been said elsewhere, but in a way it is also worth reiterating this stuff around kind of disease and illness and the way that we respond to that, if it's something physical.
Yeah.
As opposed to when somebody's having a mental health episode of some kind and those responses. Yeah, I'm going to talk a bit more about that in relation to this book that I'm hoping to share with you in a second.
Yeah, I think that just maybe the final thing I wanted to pick up on as well was the conversation you had about masculinities, which is something that I've been really interested in my time at university. All of my essays have been focused around queer theory and sort of the multiplicity of the masculine identity. I think it's just really important that we have a whole range of people talking about the subject, and it shouldn't just be the queer community that has to kind of wave the flag for helping men to open up talking about mental health or sort of finding more positive ways to express themselves or identify within the kind of realms of the masculine.
Yeah, I felt, I really enjoyed, you know, he was sort of giving it a light touch in a way, but the Kevin's kind of thing around being like, I'm a northern bloke and this is how the conversations go.
Yeah.
And it's just as simple as kind of sometimes not having the vocabulary. It's like learnt behaviour, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's sort of like this thing of kind of him just going, yeah, I've been, you know, trying to help my friends to have this kind of check-in process. And I think sometimes we expect communication to be this organic thing, or emotions to be these things that just flow and then we roll with them. But actually, you learn how to manage emotions and you learn how to communicate with people, and we choose how to do that in the context of different relationships. And then you sort of learn these methods, I guess, in a way. And that sounds really clinical, but I think it's also, you know, there's a lot of overwhelm in the world right now. So it's kind of also a way to sort of navigate this brilliantly open kind of identity forming world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of fluid and open, but that also can be quite overwhelming when you're trying to figure out who you are or how you relate to people, right?
Yeah.
So let's have some maps. Let's have some guidelines, please.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think talking about sort of getting my male friends to open up a little bit or be comfortable talking about the deep, dark emotions. I think people who are sort of at a place where you're perhaps more comfortable with talking about your feelings or maybe your identity and expressing that, you can end up sort of playing, for better or for worse, kind of like a mirror role into society, and people can kind of look at you and go, yeah, they can talk about these things. And I think it is a position that holds quite a lot of responsibility. And it can be quite, I think it can be quite a burden sometimes, because, you know, if people see you as kind of a grounded, happy individual, then quite often that can be a magnet for sort of like, oh, that I can get what they have, not in sort of like an unkind way, but
yeah,
needing that.
No, I feel you as a, and in a group dynamic sometimes, right? You end up feeling like it's your responsibility to maybe speak up about stuff
right,
the whole
exactly.
time, and then you're, but then that's also you sort of sticking your neck out again,
yeah.
You know, and it's sometimes you're like, oh, I'm tired actually of doing this, and I don't necessarily want to always be that person. So yeah, kind of expanding whose voices we're hearing and yeah, allowing all of those voices to be heard, I guess, and however, whatever ways we can. I mean, I definitely, at the end, when I there was something I wanted to pick up on actually, because I said to Kevin, oh, I don't think it's that controversial what he was saying about dance, contemporary dance being white middle class women. Hi. Case in point. Bam!
And I only miss one of those boxes. So, yeah.
You miss it by quite a long way.
Ah, yeah.
But I suppose the controversy in that is that is where this kind of feminist and queer dialogues kind of intersect and diverge and kind of finding those points of tension, because where the controversy is maybe for me is that, yes, it is, but also when you get to the higher up jobs, it's still largely men in a female-dominated field. And that has been, again, it's an old discussion in a way that we're still having to have. Mm. But the relationship that women have to dancing and ideas of femininity is also deeply problematic and causes a lot of issues. Again, something that my students often want to write about, actually, is body image and mental health. Mm. And you know, I don't know if the essays are always the best channel for it, but it's definitely a very real issue. And so I guess, yeah, that sort of, for me, was maybe where I dismissed something that actually I was like, no, that is a complex, kind of slightly controversial topic, actually.
We might need a whole separate episode.
I think we need a separate episode. But there's also a hierarchy in terms of, like, privilege. And I think gender is higher up than race. So in that way, yeah, you know, I absolutely kind of take his point as well.
Yeah.
But just that it's complex. So, do you want to join me in a bit of geeking out?
Yes, please.
I feel like I've kind of gone off-piste with the geek outs of late, because they've been either non-existent or kind of smaller chunk, bite-sized chunks. But the bottom line is, I guess, is how I've been really, like, enlivened and inspired by a lot of dance scholarship and how I can bring that into these conversations. The book I have this week is not a dance scholar.
Dun, dun, dun.
Shock, horror. It kind of is, because to me, like, there's a real joy in waving the flag for dance scholarship, because it's been really marginalised within the academy. However, I will give a shout out to Barbara Einrich's book, Dancing in the Streets, because that is a sort of precursor, I guess, in a way, and it's referenced in this book, which is called Radical Happiness: Moments of Collective Joy by Lynn Segal. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing all these names wrong. She's a feminist academic and social theorist, Australian, based in the UK. And I think the reason I thought it would be relevant to bring to this podcast is that although it's talking about happiness, it's very much sort of critiquing the sort of happiness industry in a way that's kind of grown up around this idea of well-being. And it was a word I used in the interview with Kevin. I think he even used it. But it also is kind of makes me cringe, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's become quite a commercial term, hasn't it?
Yes.
Like, you can sell well-being. You can have someone come into your office and teach your sort of workers how to be well, which is bizarre.
Exactly. And somehow also I associate it with quite a kind of middle class, affluent kind of thing, where you're able to kind of invest in your well-being.
Right, it's a total privilege to have the time to set aside to do that. It's like beyond surviving, it's kind of...
Exactly. Yeah. But that's not necessarily what we meant by it in the context of that interview, but I think it's just interesting to pick it up in relation to this book, which is, yeah, talking about how these studies on what makes us happy are often kind of also driven by profit, right? Because that's kind of the ultimate goal. It's like happiness, the holy grail. But in more poetic terms, contained within that is always a kind of bittersweet understanding that of loss, I guess, is a big part of what she's saying. But the bit that I wanted to kind of pick out is that she talks about a book called Depression, A Public Feeling, in which another surname I'm not going to be able to pronounce, Anne Chetkovic, talks about thinking of depression as a cultural and social phenomenon rather than a medical disease. And so it's kind of shifting away from the individual to thinking about how the structures of capitalist and neoliberal society are actually hugely responsible for the amount of depression and anxiety that exists in the world. And I think, I guess what I like about that is it takes the burden off the individual, right? So Cechevic is one of many scholars, especially queer scholars, who have drawn inspiration from Eve Sedgwick, another feminist writer, in finding words for their own experiences of depression. What these writers emphasise is the lack of attention paid to the social influences on those most vulnerable to depression and despair. Eng notes that all the evidence shows that women, homosexuals, people of colour and post-colonialists seem to be at greatest risk for melancholy and depression in contemporary society. She also talks about, though, how loss can function as a potentially creative, productive force in history, providing support and meaning for new forms of activism and refashioned identities. Understanding the lineages of loss, whether from war, genocide, exile, migration, AIDS, or any number of past traumas, can supply the tools for pondering what remains afterwards, and hence for both a possible rewriting of the past as well as a reimagining of the future. The dancing future.
Yeah. I feel like I need to mull that over. I want to read that book.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, you can all mull it over. It's a lot to kind of digest, but I guess, there's this idea of reparative reading in there, or reparative writing as well, which is the opposite of paranoid reading, where you're kind of searching for truth.
Right.
It's where you're searching for making alternative meanings. So, and that really resonates with kind of queer culture and this idea of creating other identities. And I guess the reason I bring it up also is like I said, this thing of, although Kevin wasn't specifically talking about depression, he's talking more about bipolar, which has a different set of kind of expressions of symptoms, etc. But I think with all of these things, it's kind of recognizing how the forces of society and are impacting hugely what people's lived experiences are.
Yeah.
And so, having the wherewithal to pay for a few yoga classes isn't necessarily going to solve that.
We're going for your daily walk.
Go for your daily walk, damn it. Yeah, but, at the same time, I think ending... I love the fact that we're in this...
Yeah,
we're in this
strange sounds.
Strange building with, sounds all around us. I hope that the listeners can feel the atmosphere. Yeah, but also the simplicity of Kevin's invitation that if you move your body, you will feel better.
Yeah.
Is still in amongst all of that, the overwhelm of all of those structural inequalities, there is that individual power to kind of take agency over your body to whatever degree you can. And that is a little moment that could potentially create a bit of that elusive joy bubbling up. I hope so. Oh, thank you, Luca.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed this month's episode. If you're hungry for more, please follow us on Spotify at the Dance Futures Podcast. You can also find us on Instagram at Dance Futures Podcast for more behind the scenes goodies and updates. Thanks so much. Bye.